In a world where the sense of identity is tied to work and careers, to stop working often is to become nobody. In his new book, Last Works, Lessons in Leaving, religion professor Mark Taylor explores the final reflections of writers and thinkers from Kierkegaard to David Foster Wallace. How did they either face or avoid ending and leaving? What do their lessons and ending teach us about living in the time that remains for us? Some leavings brought relief, even joy, while others brought pain and suffering. Whether the cause was infirmity, impending death, or simply exhaustion, the ways that these individuals' voices fell silent offer poignant examples of people negotiating the challenges of ending. Taylor probes how the art of living involves learning to leave gracefully. Mark Taylor is professor of religion at Columbia University and a frequent contributor to The New York Times, as well as NPR. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Taylor to the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. At what point did you start to realize that you had a book here?
Well, I've been thinking about some of these issues for quite a while, partly in relationship to some of the other books that I had written, but also partly related to changes that are taking place socially at this time. I think as I watched friends and colleagues approach the end of their careers, I am struck very often by how many of them have difficulty in retiring and letting go. And that, in part, set me to thinking about how the difficulties of negotiating departures.
So when you looked at those departing, who did you want to look at? What was it about, certainly, writers and the last works of people of artistic types that you found fascinating?
Well, you know, I've spent my life teaching and reading and writing about major figures, and in many ways, these figures are what I call my ghosts. They're people with whom I've lived for many years. They're thinkers I think are worth thinking about. They're demanding thinkers. They're not easy thinkers, but they're figures who have wrestled seriously with life's problems. Life's problems that we inevitably encounter, but often spend much of our lives trying to avoid. So those were the figures that I to whom I turned.
In turning to those figures, and it is quite a list, everyone from Nietzsche to Freud to Poe to Ernest Hemingway and Virginia Woolf, Herman Melville, Henry David Thoreau. Were you looking for commonality? Did you find commonality, or were you looking for a great sort of swath of difference in how people left their work?
I was looking for read again. These are figures that have intrigued me for many years. There's a strong autobiographical element in the book. It's not only writers that that have been influential for me, but you know, some years ago I thought I had written my last book and taught my last course when I was very seriously ill. I did not go into it looking for commonalities, but I found more commonalities than I might have expected. The German philosopher Hegel said at one point that the happy eras are the blank pages of history. Whether or not that's true, it does seem to me to be true. The troubled lives lead to good literature. Contented lives lead to no literature. These figures lived very troubled lives, many of them wrestling with illness or mental illness. One of the things that struck me that I sort of knew but didn't realize was how young so many were when they died. Kierkegaard was 43. Poe was 39. Thoreau was 44. At 45, Nietzsche slipped into madness and remained catatonic, more or less, for 5 years. You know, on and on. And the other thing that that impressed me was how many of them wrote so intensely for such a short period of time. Again, Kierkegaard wrote everything he published in 13 years. Melville wrote everything he published in 12 years, and then slipped into virtual silence for another 45 years, died completely unknown. So each of these has a different story to tell. Three of them committed suicide: Hemingway, Virginia Woolf, and David Foster Wallace. People do not realize how much Freud suffered. He suffered from mouth cancer, cancer of the mouth, for much of his life. Had over 30 operations on his mouth, and eventually asked that he be put to death, which he was. So these are difficult lives. I would say the other thing that I found that was interesting is that I often tell my students that the only writers really worth reading who are writers who could not write. They're obsessed in a certain way, or possessed in a certain way. And I think their writing is the way in which they're working out the difficulties with which they are living. In many ways for these writers, but I would say this is a broader observation, literature and art displace religion as the source, as the locus for working with these issues. And all of these writers are in one way wrestling with these fundamental existential problems that we all face.
Talk a little bit about that wrestling, what they were wrestling with. Were they trying to find answers, or were they just trying to come up with the right questions?
I think more coming up with the right questions. You know, these are thinkers who know enough to know there aren't really final answers. I also think that it's important to understand how crucial this kind of writing and reading are for today's world. We're forgetting how to read. It's not that we don't read at all, but we don't read seriously. We don't read thoughtfully. We don't read reflectively. These books are demanding, and they take time to read and to think about, time that many people feel they don't have today. I think that for all of them in different ways, they were torn. They were conflicted. And they seek through their writing some kind of, not necessarily a resolution, but some kind of way to mediate or negotiate the conflicts that tear them apart.
When you consider the time, of course, that it takes to figure this out, and sometimes they were up against the clock, weren't they? So what is it about of having death staring at you that does that? Does that change the conversation? Does that change the result when time is of the essence?
Yes, I think so. And I do think time is of the essence. One of the last books that I wrote was called Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Part of the point there is that we're living in a high-speed world, but that high-speed world often leads to distractions. Kierkegaard says at one point, death is a good dancing partner. And by that he means that the facing of death honestly and directly focuses the mind and brings us into greater clarity about what we are, what we have become, and what we might be in the short time that we have left. Nietzsche, in the 6 months before he slipped into madness, was his most prolific period of writing. He wrote 4 different works within a very, very short span of time, again, almost as if possessed. Poe, at the time that he was writing his last long prose poem, was, for extended periods of time, in an alcoholic stupor, died on the streets of Baltimore, unknown at the time, and too indigent to have a burial. So they, you know, and David Foster Wallace, who was certainly one of the most influential recent writers who ended his own life, was racked by psychological problems and despair, and again, tried to work through these. He did not finish. I mean, that was one of the interesting challenges with this, deciding exactly which work was the last work. Because they didn't all finish their works. David Foster Wallace left about 1,000 unedited pages, which his editor eventually put into its final form. Nietzsche, it's not a work that I considered, left a series of aphorisms that his sister, who was politically compromised by her association with National Socialists, put into a book that was titled, published under the title, The Will to Power. So each of these writers poses a different set of problems with respect to the kind of text that they were dealing with. But definitely, again, not all of them knew they were going to die. I mean, Thoreau was suffering from tuberculosis. His brother had died, and his sister had died some years earlier, and his sister had recently died. And he for sure knew he was going to die. And he spent his last years and months pulling together an extraordinarily unusual book that was more or less a catalog of plant life in the area around Concord, with very, very careful observations about different leaves and fruits and flowers. And some of his last writings were, his last writing that is included in that book is Autumn Leaves, which is one of the most eloquent, I end with that. It's one of the most eloquent statements about death and leaving that I know.
Why do you think so many of these stories, not all, but so many of these stories, when you look at these last works, have so many of these minds in sadness and in turmoil? Can anything be said about the artistic life and the life of a writer and a thinker that invites itself to a point where the ending, in many cases, is one of misery?
Again, it's a complicated set of issues, and you know, there's, I want to avoid the temptation of sort of romanticizing the unhappy soul, or what Hegel, who's a very influential philosopher for me, but one about whom I chose not to write in this book, what he calls unhappy consciousness. I mean, as I said before, I think it's that condition of discontent that leads one to write. I don't think that the writing leads to the discontent. I think the discontent generates the writing. It's a quest. They're always after that which they cannot completely comprehend or grasp. And in a certain way, that's what keeps the future open. Again, I will often say to my students, I say, you think you want satisfaction, but you don't. Satisfaction is death. Desire. I mean, it's the unsatisfied desire that keeps the future open in a certain way. And that future is not always necessarily a bright one. I mean, to face the future openly is to face its uncertainty. And Kierkegaard, among others, will talk about the uncertainty of the future as precipitating a certain kind of dread. But the only thing more dreadful than the uncertainty of that future is its certainty. Having arrived is having nowhere left to go, and it's that sense of never having arrived that keeps, I think, life going. I would also say, and this is from personal experience, that the experience of really confronting death, or of, as I say, dying without having died, need not lead to a certain pessimism and darkness. In my own experience, that experience of death without dying was extremely liberating. Having encountered that and knowing you're going to be there again, as will we all, rather than leading to depression, creates a certain kind of release that makes it possible to accept life in its uncertainties all the more fully.
What do you hope for readers is the takeaway?
I hope they'll read, for one thing. And I don't mean that in a trivial sense. I sometimes ponder about the contradictions of spending one's life writing long, demanding books for an age in which people don't read long, demanding books. But I think, again, when you ask whether they are looking for answers or questions, I think the questions that these writers pose are inevitable for any thoughtful person. It's the reason I teach what I teach and write what I write, to engage students or readers in reflection upon the problems with which they are going to inevitably have to wrestle in their own ways. And it's not answers, but it's to cultivate a certain kind of thoughtful reflection, which in today's high-speed, noisy world is all too rare.
The name of the book is Last Works, Lessons in Leaving. The book is published by Yale University Press. Mark Taylor, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe, very, very much. My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Last Works, Lessons in Leaving. It's published by Yale. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.